What happens when a leading technical provider for global abortion and contraception services decides to shift from a hub and spoke organizational model to a more horizontal model? This is what I discuss with Anu Kumar, the president of IPAS or IPAS today. We discuss why IPAS came to this decision, what strategy shift was underlying this choice, what form of decentralized decision-making did it result in, what does it mean to aspire to work as a network, what kind of decision rights and authority shifted from whom to whom, and what are the as yet unfinished parts of this agenda, and what may be the trade-offs. If you want to learn from an organization who did go down the path of actualizing the mandate to, quote, shift the power, IPAS is a good example, and you'd better listen in. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over 3 decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, listeners. This is NGO Soul and Strategy. Organizations in civil society are always undergoing change. The one thing, as the cliche says, that is constant is change. Lately, that change, in the case of some NGOs at least, has been with the aim of, one could call it democratizing the organization, making it more egalitarian, making it flatter, for sure less global north dominated, with greater primacy of global south leaders and managers, etc. And sometimes such a change agenda leads to a significant change in organizational structure. And IPAS, which is a network that we're going to talk about in a moment, a global network that works globally to advance reproductive justice by expanding abortion and contraception, has spoken and written publicly for the last couple of years about its change objectives and its ambitions. And I am therefore excited today to talk with Anu Kumar, to have her on the show to tell us about the why, the what, and particularly the how of the change process. So welcome, Anu.
Thank you for having me, Tosca.
Here we go. So Anu, for those who don't know her, she is the president and CEO of IPAS. We'll talk in a moment about what IPAS is. She was also in the past its chief strategy and development officer, its executive vice president. She was also a senior program officer at the MacArthur Foundation on Population and Reproductive Rights, a program officer at the MacArthur Foundation as well, and a social scientist at the WHO. So Anu, first the basics. What is IPAS's mission, for those who don't know it? Tell us just briefly, but importantly, about the sectors that you work in, because there's, I think, salience there. How old is the organization? What size are you? And what was your organizational structure before you started the change journey?
Sure. Thank you, Tosca. So IPAS is a global reproductive justice organization that, as you say, focuses on access to abortion and contraception. We are the leading global technical agency on those two topics, abortion and contraception. We are 50 years old, actually, we're 51 years old now. So we have a great deal of experience and expertise in this topic. We have over 400 staff around the world and 18 country offices, but programming in many more locations around the world, including the United States.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
very necessary here in the United States, I would argue.
It is. That's what we think as well. Yeah. And there's a lot that the United States has to learn, I think, from the rest of the world as well. So previous to this iteration of the organization, we were essentially quite a traditional hub and spoke international NGO. We had a headquarters. We had country offices that were kind of, you know, in relation to or reported into the headquarters in the United States. But I think one distinction from IPAS and others is that IPAS has always had local staff in our country offices. So we've never had expats. All of our staff are from the locations and countries in which we're operating. And that has actually over the years made a huge difference in our effectiveness and in our ability to actually achieve our mission. But this new journey this new structure is different, and we can get into that in a moment. But before we do, you know, one of the reasons why we made the changes that we did is because of our strategy. And you asked about sort of, you know, what is our approach? What is our strategy? So we have adopted a sustainable abortion ecosystem framework, and we've defined it. So for many years, you know, there was always this discussion about sustainability and what does that look like in health and development. So we decided that, okay, enough talk. Let's actually think about and define what does sustainable abortion care look like. And we, you know, came up with a lovely diagram, which you can find on our website, that consists of 8 components of the sustainable abortion ecosystem. But the key factor, and the reason I bring this up and why it's relevant to this conversation, is that it demands local knowledge and expertise. Ecosystems are deeply contextual, right? They can, you know, we cannot in the United States know what the ecosystem is in Nepal or Nigeria or Mexico. No. You have to have that local understanding. And so the organizational changes to our operating model were really rooted in ensuring that our strategy, our sustainable abortion ecosystem strategy, would be successful.
I see. That's very interesting. And of course, the important point again, you started with strategy and only then did you think about what structure or a decision rights allocation, authority allocation, et cetera, and who is part of what deliberation needed to be. So I have to tell you first, ask you first, is so in your LinkedIn article, which we will put in the show notes, you talked about the nature of the organizational change process and that a structure is only one part of it, as it should be, right? You've talked a little bit already about the impetus behind it, but I'd like you to now unpack a little bit more. What was the nature of the change? Where, if I think about strategy, structure, people, decision rights and authority, and culture, where were the biggest shifts?
So we very purposefully in the beginning, so first of all, the conversation around what's typically been called in our sector decentralization has been active in IPAS for years, if not decades. And so I stepped into that conversation when I became CEO, and I was asked by our country leadership to define what decentralization means to me. And that resulted in actually a collaborative process, me, the executive team at the time, and country leadership to talk about, okay, what do we mean by decentralization in the context of our work here at IPAS? And then came the overlay of the Black Lives Matter movement, which was deeply significant to me. And I think, you know, as one of very few women of color and really people of color in top CEO roles in global health organizations, it really mattered to me. And I paid a lot of attention to it. And it caused me to kind of really reflect on my own complicity in white supremacy and the sector's complicity in white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And so one of the first things I wrote actually was a blog for Think Global Health called White Supremacy and Global Health. And so I bring that up because equity, racial justice, these ideas and values were very much in my head and in the head of those, you know, working at IPASS as well. And then we, you know, come to a very volatile part time in history. The development sector is in upheaval because of COVID-19. We are all in upheaval because of COVID-19. And COVID-19 really did an excellent job of laying bare the inequities that we face as a planet and as a people. You know, you'll remember the discussions, I'm sure, around vaccine inequity, around treatment. So all of these things kind of came into, you know, into our thinking. And so when I sort of thought about what vision do we want for the organization, those were the values that I wanted to enshrine in some way. I didn't have a predetermined idea of organizational structure. And so the process that I used, in fact, was to invite country colleagues, country directors, and country leaders to work with. Actually, initially, I said, please talk among yourselves and think about these values and advise on what do you think our organizational structure should look like. And they kind of pretty quickly came back to me and said, no, you can't just walk away. You need to be here in these conversations. And so I participated in those conversations. And then what ended up happening was a group of country directors plus the executive team met over the course of a year to really flesh out what do we mean practically when we talk about these? What does this mean in actual real life? And we came to two conclusions. First is we need to change our management approach, and we adopted a shared leadership approach to management, and we defined what that meant for IPASS. And then we said, you know, we really need to think about changing behaviors and practices first before we look at our structure.
Hallelujah. Thank you for saying that. That is an important thing that one will hear me say to. Yeah, keep going.
No, exactly. Because, you know, you can change the structure, but if you haven't changed your mindset, then what have you changed? And so, you know, you won't make really tangible progress. And so we started working, this was, you know, 3.5-4 years ago now, we started working on how to make behavioral changes by practicing horizontal decision making, first learning it and then practicing it in sort of very, tangible decisions like budget allocation. Things, money is often where the power is, hiring, recruitment. And so we started doing these things. And then at the same time, we were thinking, okay, well, what kind of organizational structure do we want? And we did some research on that. You know, we kind of looked around and said, okay, what's out there? What would be most appropriate for us, given, again, our sustainable abortion ecosystem model and framework?
Yeah.
And then we landed on the network model.
And before you go there, may I just interrupt for a moment and ask you, horizontal decision-making model, for instance, apply to practical topics and consequential topics like budget, right? Resource allocation, hiring, recruitment, et cetera. What did that look like in this case?
Well, there's actually really practical techniques and tools that one can learn and use in order to make decisions in a kind of a horizontal way. There is, for example, one of the things that we did in the resource allocation conversation. Well, first of all, we decided that it wouldn't be the executive team that would make that decision. Which is not to say the executive team wasn't involved. There was an executive that was involved, but there were other people also invited into the conversation. So we formed essentially a committee. And that committee got together and said, this is the criteria that we're going to be using to make this decision. All of the criteria was transparent and shared. Mm-hmm. Then the decision or the criteria was applied to the problem at hand, to the issue at hand. Mm-hmm. And then we checked back. So, you know, we got the data back. The committee got the data back, and then they made recommendations. And they said, okay, this is what we think we should do with this particular resource allocation decision. And they applied some of the techniques, which include things like making a proposal and then having the proposal be discussed and a very, I would say, codified or organized discussion process. It's not I'm not an expert on it, but I've certainly participated in these quite a lot. So what happens is that, you'll make a proposal, say, I think we should go out to dinner at, this restaurant tonight. And then the group that receives that says, the first round is around clarifications. Mm-hmm. So the clarifications is like, when you say restaurant, do you mean cafeteria or do you mean actually a sit-down restaurant? When you say dinner, do you mean dinner, the meal that we have between 6 and 7, or do you mean lunch, as they say in other parts of the world? These kinds of clarifying questions to make sure that everybody fully understands the proposal.
Yeah.
The next round then is reaction. The reaction, which, and we typically mix these two up. We typically will ask a clarifying question and a reaction at the same time. But in this process, you separate out these things.
Okay.
So then you have a reaction. I don't like your idea of going out for dinner. I'm too busy tonight. I'm really, whatever. And then the person that's made the proposal takes all of these things in and makes a counter proposal in real time. And then the counter proposal is heard by the group. And if they feel like their issues have been dealt with, then there's a visual confirmation of, are we all willing to live with this proposal? And the catchphrase is it good enough for now, safe enough to try? Because we're not aiming for perfection. Mm-hmm. We're aiming for good enough to try. And then you actually visually confirm by giving like a thumbs up or an affirmative, yes, I'm in this.
Okay.
Or you have an objection.
Yeah.
And you voice the objection and say, I absolutely cannot go out to dinner. I find this objectionable and I will not do it. And then the group has to find another way. Then you have to go back and say, okay, well, we clearly are not ready to move on this. We need to think about this in a different way or come back in a week or whatever it is, it might be,
Okay.
So there's an organized way in making these decisions.
Yeah.
And they happen quickly. This is something that I've been quite surprised by.
They can, Anil. And it's surprising to me because in the world of team coaching that I'm amongst others trained in, we also have decision-making modes that teams can learn that are high quality yet quick, right? And I find that in our world of NGOs and nonprofits, there's a lot of deliberation, a lot of discussion, but it's not very, and I'll get to that in a moment, also in one of my questions, it's not necessarily, it doesn't result to high quality decisions or ones where everybody feels at least heard and where they can live with it, right? And a lot of time is spent in it. So you say you adopted some structured decision-making process as part of the horizontal decision-making that helped. And I guess we shouldn't go too much further into the tactile details, but I did want to hear you about this because I think that's useful learning for others.
Yeah. And one of the benefits of this process is that every person, as you say, has a voice. So if I'm present in this group, my voice counts just as much as anybody else's. And my voice doesn't count more just because I'm CEO. Than anybody else's,
Although one could argue, of course, that you being in a room, right? I don't even have to finish that sentence, right?
There is
some underlying, but yeah.
And it's a good point because we have actually adopted, we're very conscious about who's in the room, and representation of country voices is very important. So in the beginning of this process, we mandated that, if a group of was going to be a group of 10, then 15 needed to be from outside the U.S. 10, 7 needed to be outside the U.S., a majority needed to be outside the U.S. So things like that, so that we ensured that the U.S. voices and hierarchical voices or those that hold positional authority would not dominate the conversation.
So both from not from inside the U.S., but also those that do not, did I hear you say that?
That's
do
right.
not have positional authority. Forms of authority. do not.
Oh, okay. That's right.
That's
yeah. Yeah. And I can say a little bit more about that on our org structure if you want to go there.
Go ahead.
Well, so we did eventually get to organizational structure, right? Mm-hmm. It took us a few years, but we got there recently. And the changes that we made were to, first of all, dissolve the executive team, which does not mean that we don't have executives. So we still have executives. We still have a CEO, we have a chief operating officer, and we have a chief financial officer. But we don't have an executive team that is the overall governing body of the organization. Mm. Instead, we have what we call the network leadership group. This is a 5-person group that consists of 2 people from Africa, because Africa is our largest program area and region, 1 person from Asia, 1 from Latin America, and 1 from the United States. And this group was selected by staff. So we established criteria. We established a term of reference. People raised their hands and said, yes, I meet the criteria and I want to play this, serve on this body. And then staff as a whole voted on who would be in this body. I am not on this, on the body. I'm not in this group. Neither is the CFO or the COO on this group. The US remains on the group because the US continues to be the financially consolidating node for the network, right? So this is the network leadership group. In addition, we created something called the Staff Community Council. And, you know, this links back to that conversation we just had about positional authority. The Staff Community Council consists of a person from every node in the network, but it's a staff person who is not a manager. So not a supervisor, not a manager, not in sort of a formal leadership role, but is essentially a staff person who is implementing a lot of the work, most of the work that we're doing. And that group serves both as a check and balance to the network leadership group, mm-hmm. but also a catalyzing group for some of the work that needs to be done across the network.
That's so a culture work, the kind of culture care?
Partly, like, for example, right now they're working on developing quality standards, both technical and operational quality standards for the network. And these are the people that actually, you know, have to follow these standards. So they're the appropriate ones to set them. Exactly. It doesn't make any sense for, you know, me to set the quality standards when I'm not the one that's actually going to be doing them.
Also do not work in the context in which
people. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, and then we also created a third body, which is called NetCare. And, you know, we acknowledge that networks require care and feeding. You know, you can't just sort of set this structure off and then walk away. They require communication, coordination. And so the NetCare team, which is a global team, is responsible for that kind of care and feeding and upkeep of the network itself. They're not making decisions, but they are kind of helping the network leadership group, the staff community council, and any node in the network that says, we don't understand how to do this. We're not sure what to do and what process we should follow here.
So supporting and role clarification.
Exactly.
And processes, et cetera. Now, just to be clear, I know how long have you lived in this new structure?
So the new structure came into place last August. So not too long.
Not too long.
Yeah, exactly. Early days.
And also one clarifying question, going back to what you said about horizontal decision making. When you said budget, did you mean the whole IPAS budget, the global budget, or did you mean on specific nuggets of the budget?
Yeah. So in the beginning, it was around specific, you know, either we had to make budget cuts or we received a grant and we had to allocate the funding. It was around that. We have always had a budget committee, a staff-led budget committee to do the organizational budget. Now, the network leadership group is going to be doing, they're going to be taking the lead in the next organizational budgeting process. Mm. So the network leadership group is not the equivalent of the executive team, right? They're not the same. They do 2 things. They're responsible for setting unrestricted budget allocations, and they're responsible for strategy.
Okay.
So sort of important. Looking very important, very, very important, but not like day-to-day management. So, you know, they're not, they don't, you know, country staff don't report into them, you know, reporting relationships haven't changed. So that network leadership group is kind of looking across the network and saying, okay, you know, for example, you know, they looked at our organizational strategic performance against our strategic plan and are saying, well, we need to do better here. We need to do more effort there. We seem, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
To kind of make sense of the whole.
Yeah.
And then in the budgeting process, that's going to partially going to be their role also. They'll get information and data from the CFO, right? And they'll be told, here's what the financial picture looks like this year, next year, the year after. And then they're going to sort of set the budgetary direction for the organization, you know, in as much as we have flexibility, you know, as you know, so much of our funding is restricted funding. IPAS does have unrestricted funding. And so that's where there's some room to set our own vision.
Right, right. And that's very cherished, right, resources. So given that you have lived in this new structure now since August of 2022, so far, and it may be too early, but I'm really curious about this aspect. So it's clear out of what impetus you've done it. It's clear to what the benefits might be. Right now, let me ask you, besides that, what has happened in your decision-making practices? What has happened, if anything, to your ability to be adaptive, to be responsive to changing environments, and agility of decision-making so far?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's twofold. What I'm observing so far is that on the one hand, we are able to move faster and make decisions with less process, particularly those who are working in countries. And also we have what we're calling service nodes that, you know, so these are, you know, development or, you know, fundraising, communications, these kinds of services. Those nodes can make decisions on their own fairly quickly. And that, I think, is especially important for country programs. So there's less having to go all the way up the chain of command and back down again in order to make a decision.
That's because of the decentralization of decision-making authority for those.
Exactly. Okay. And also, you know, and really because of the shared leadership approach. I mean, one of the things about shared leadership is that everyone is responsible for the organization and everyone has authority in the organization to make decisions. So it is within your purview. The purview of your job allows you to make certain decisions. Make them. Do them. And, you know, and if you feel like you need to ask someone for help or a consultation, go ahead. Nobody's stopping you. You can ask any of your colleagues, but you don't have to. So, you know, I think that this is resulting in more programmatic decisions that are, you know, being made more quickly. It's also resulting in a great deal of more cross-country collaboration, because again, the U.S. is not in the middle.
Yeah.
So. Exactly. So the countries are reaching out to each other on a regional basis or even just a one-on-one basis. For example, there was an exchange between our Mozambique office and our Bolivia office, which never would have happened, I don't think, in the past. But they just kind of made it happen and said, yeah, we really want to learn what they're doing on gender-based violence and what they're, you know, and so there was an exchange.
Right.
You know,
so you were saying that on the one hand, the first thing you be able to take decisions faster when it comes to programmatic decisions, because people don't have to go up the chain. And I think there was more.
Yes. On the other hand, I think there is, at this moment at least, a little bit of lack of clarity around roles. And so people are kind of erring on the side of asking for a lot of consultation and feedback, you know, so they're a little bit concerned about can I make this decision? And who exactly? We're so conditioned to asking people in positions of authority for their approval, you know, so people very often don't feel comfortable making the decision on their own. And so they seek out others to kind of give them that that comfort.
Comfort.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is resulting in some degree, I think, of lack of clarity, and, you know, a sense of, well, can I just do this? Do I need to ask? What happens if I just do this? You know, it's so we're, you know, it's a point in our history right now with this new change where we're kind of unlearning old ways of doing things and learning new ways. And we're right in the middle of that.
That uncomfortable in between, right? Where innovation is possible and is happening, but people do not feel secure. So it's both, it has a positive aspect, but also has a negative aspect, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
What happens to, in this new structure, what have you seen so far, or what could you imagine in terms of two things I was thinking of? Global coherence. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned that a group is already working on quality standards, but also so global coherence. And there are many interdependencies within the organization, right? So if decision-making has been pushed down much more to the country level, how are those interdependencies still taken account of?
Yeah, great question. So global coherence is something that we spent, particularly in the early days of this organizational change process, quite a bit of time on. We actually codified what we, and wrote down a network collaboration agreement. And this was an agreement between the IPAS US node and the country nodes. And it specified to be part of the IPAS network, you have to adhere to certain things legally, including around financial reporting, around fundraising, around brand, around mission. And so, you know, we wrote those down, and every node of the network signed that collaboration agreement. Now, you know, it is a legally binding document, but by no means do we want to enforce or have, you know, litigation amongst ourselves. Like, that's not the goal here. But we wanted to get it all down on paper so that everybody understood what it means to be part of the IPAS network. And it does mean certain things. It means you comply with the organizational mission. You comply with the organizational brand. There's a lot of flexibility in all of these things, mm-hmm. but there's a basic kind of expectation of in terms of what it means. So global coherence in that way is sort of written down.
Yeah.
The interdependency issue is trickier, I would say, because that requires a lot of coordination and communication.
Yeah.
And you see that especially when it comes to fundraising, or at least it matters a lot more when it comes to fundraising, because money is involved and that always matters. So, you know, for IPAS, it's not as if we have hundreds and hundreds of donors. We have a finite number of donors, and they fund multiple areas and countries for at IPAS. So we have to have excellent communication.
Anu?
For this, yeah.
There you are. You were frozen for a moment, or on my end. Anyway, keep going.
It does say my internet is unstable. But anyway, so it just requires this level of communication so that we.
I can't hear you right now. There you are. Can you hear me?
Hi.
Hi, there you are.
Sorry.
So the last thing that you said, it does require a lot of coordination as well as communication to ensure interdependencies are recognized.
That's right. To recognize that, you know, we are working on a common area and topic. And it's not just about fundraising. It's also really about achievement of our mission, because we don't want to be recreating the wheel in every single location.
Right.
We want to build on what we've learned in Bolivia to Mozambique to Nepal. And so to keep kind of moving and pushing the agenda forward.
Yes.
So it is requiring more attention to that kind of knowledge sharing.
What does that attention look like?
Yeah, it's looking at, so we've established communities of practice for different topical areas.
Okay.
There's a research monitoring and evaluation community of practice, for example. There's one on climate. There are different topical areas. Was an HR community of practice. And so that allows people from across the network who are focused or experts on a particular area to get together and discuss, you know, what are they seeing? What are their issues that they're facing, et cetera? Mm-hmm. So communities of practice is one way. We're also holding more, I would say, meetings, kind of virtual as well as in-person meetings across the network to share information and to share knowledge across and to build contact and connection with one another.
Okay. I'm going to push you a little bit on that last point. So it's my, and this is my opinion, feel free to disagree. In our sector, we spend a hell of a lot of time in meetings. Do you think that this need for synchronous encounters, these meetings, is stronger in the new structure than before?
I do. And at the moment, and I think you raise a really good point, because I do worry about the expense that's involved in this. So I'm kind of waiting and watching. I think some of this need on the part of staff to get together, I think there's two forces pushing this. One is that the U.S. office is all remote. Mm-hmm. So we are not in person any longer. And I think many of our team members would like to be in conversation, face-to-face conversation with others in the organization. So that, you know, is pushing us to kind of get together in person a little bit more. And then the second is this, the novelty of this organizational structure, of this network, and perhaps a bit of a fear that, that it will result in dissolution or, you know, dissolving of the bonds that bring us together.
Understood.
Yeah. So I understand it. I think it's interesting. We'll just have to wait and see.
Wait and see. Yeah, that's what experimentation is also about, right? I'm going to jump for a moment and say something. Sometimes networked type of organization can cause what somebody called Morgan called a tyranny of structurelessness. And sometimes in feminist leadership and governance writings, like by Srilata Bhatliwala, for instance, there is an acknowledgement that that's not necessarily where we want to go, right? So how do you want to comment on that in the context of IPAS's changes?
Yeah, that's a great question, because so while we are a network, we are not without hierarchy. And while we are, you know, practicing these horizontal decision making processes, there are still supervisors, managers, and bosses in the organization. And so we have reduced our hierarchy, but we have not eliminated our hierarchy. And I think that's why I was so careful in describing what we describe as shared leadership as being a management approach. You know, it's a management approach that says we want to include other voices in the decisions and other ideas in the decisions, but the decision is still held by someone. There is still a decider.
Super important that there, in the end, is still one person or a small group that decides. Yes, and that too tends to, I find, in larger, very complex confederated and federated organizations, it tends to be forgotten.
Right. And actually, we specifically did not select federated or confederated partially for that reason, because we thought it actually engenders greater bureaucracy. And so we wanted to kind of step away from that. We definitely did not want to have that kind of bureaucracy. So remember when I mentioned that the IPAS US remains the financially consolidating node, mm-hmm. that is actually a really important point, because the node or the organization that holds the money is also legally responsible for it and is legally responsible for the staff that are paid from that money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the reasons why we still have a chief operating officer. Mm-hmm. And so the chain of command still goes from country directors to regional directors to COO to CEO to the IPAS US Board of Directors. But the management approach is much lighter touch, right? So the management approach is such that, the country director in IPAS DRC, for example, has authority to make decisions about their programming without going up that chain of command. So that's what's shifted. What's shifted is that, we're saying, you have the country offices, for example, have the authority to do this. However, ultimately, we're still responsible. We in the U.S. are still responsible for the money. And so therefore, their fiscal systems need to be sound. Mm. Your financial reporting, your audit, your HR policies, all of these still need to be, in compliance.
Got it. Got it. Yeah, that's really, yeah. So also what I hear you say is, so there's still some hierarchy, but that hierarchy, it sounds like their remit of decision-making is much reduced, because much more of the managerial level decision-making is done at the country level.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's okay. Exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Thinking about the time, I want to make sure that we get to two more questions. One is about boards and one is about change management approaches and frameworks. So what has this all, this whole, not just the structural change, but the whole couple of years of change processes, what has that meant for the role of the board, for the division of decision-making between management and governing body, the composition of the board, and its ways of working?
Mm-hmm. So the composition of the board has been shifting for some time. Remember when I began the conversation, I started off talking about equity and centering the voices of those that we serve. And that is also part of the board mandate. And so we have board members. IPAS has always had an international board, but we're really, in the last several years, focused on having more representation from our regions and countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that shift has been taking place over several years now.
Yeah.
The board still retains, the IPAS US board still retains ultimate responsibility for IPAS resources, fiduciary responsibility, and they also have strategic oversight as well. But they channel both of those things through the CEO, right?
Mm-hmm.
As is typically the case, the board has one employee, and it's the CEO.
Yeah.
Now, the CEO has decided, in this case me, that I want to manage the organization in this way, by having this network leadership group, the shared leadership, etc. So the board was very much a part of those conversations, because I wanted them to understand and feel comfortable with the direction that I was taking. And the implications for the board themselves is, I would say, kind of limited at the moment. I mean, so long as there is the financial health of the organization is secure, the strategic implementation is solid,
mm-hmm.
you know, there is little concern from their point of view. There's interest. There's interest, right? They're very interested and they want to know.
Yeah. But not a reason to worry.
Not really. They don't have
judgment.
They don't have to, right? They don't. Yeah. They don't. It's technically not part of their remit. Now, the network model has led to other nodes in the network being more autonomous and creating their own boards.
I was going to ask you.
Yes, and in many cases in the past, those boards have been kind of nominal. They really haven't been highly functional governing bodies. So we are. That is one of the things that we are in the process of shifting and changing is, you know, kind of revitalizing those boards, getting them to a point where they actually are governing bodies. And by governing bodies, I mean that they are doing, you know, they're keeping track of the finances of the node. They're able to manage the director. You know, those kinds of. So, you know, the countries are moving down that path of having more active boards. And then I think we will come to a crossroads or a question about how should these boards interact, or should they?
Yes, because you explicitly chose not to become a federated or confederated organization. In fact, am I right in thinking that from a org structure perspective, you're still a hierarchical corporate structure, though not hierarchical the way in which one thinks about in classical organization. Is that right? You will not have multiple boards that all then have a voice in a global board, for instance.
We don't, and we don't have to. And you're right, the IPaaS Impact Network is not a legal structure. Yeah, we are still registered as a charitable organization. In the U.S. And we are registered in different ways in different countries, depending on local laws. So it is a conversation about whether we should ever have the boards interact with one another. We haven't had that need yet. And the last conversation I had with the IPaaS U.S. board, their feeling was sort of like, no, I don't really see a need to have the boards interact with one another yet, though they agreed that there should be communication to the boards. In other words, I am certainly capable and able to go to the board meetings of IPaaS Mexico, for example, should they want me to, and communicate with them and tell them what's happening in the network and, you know, have them feel part of the IPaaS network. There's no reason.
Yeah.
There's no reason that the communication can't happen. It doesn't always have to be an incredibly formal process.
Got it. Yeah. I have to ask you a quick question, but for me, it's important. Can you either say something, or if not, can you speculate? Do you think that IPaaS will be more able to be appropriately balanced in terms of external orientation on the world and what needs to change and the actors you need to influence, et cetera, and internal operations and transaction costs that come with that? I am increasingly worried that some of our organizations are so complex that their internal navel gazing has become even stronger, and it was already quite strong.
It's a very legitimate concern and worry. One of the benefits to me, however, in this process has been that I am far less involved in internal process and decision making. And so I actually am able to be far more externally facing than I was.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And that is despite what must have been extensive time spent by you along with many other actors on the very change process that we've just discussed.
Yeah. But the thing is that, you know, because its leadership has been dispersed in the organization, it's not just me that's doing these things. It's multiple people. So in a way, we've kind of shared the labor. Now that we have landed on this organizational structure with the network leadership group, you know, of five people, which I'm not on, this, you know, allows me to do other things.
That's interesting.
And I think, but I don't know, that other directors would probably feel similarly, but I don't know this yet. And I think this is definitely, you know, we have a theory of change and we have indicators, et cetera, for this whole process. And it's definitely one of the things that we will be looking at, because after all, we want to make this change and did this change in service to our mission.
Exactly. And not in service only of its staff and how it wants to or feels the need to be empowered, etc. It's one of my growing concerns. Okay, we need to bring this to a close. So can you, just in 1 or 2 minutes, can you say, is there any, when you, and I can only ask you right now, was when you started this process as a change leader amongst other change leaders, right? Have you used as an organization or you in your head mentally used certain change management frameworks or models that you've concepts that you found useful?
Oh, many. many. You know, one of the books that really influenced me was the book by Frederick Laloux on organizational development and change. I'm forgetting the name of it. You probably know it.
I know. We can put it in the in the show notes. Yeah, Laloux's book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. That had a lot of impact on me and others in the organization. There's also a book on horizontal decision making by Samantha Slade that was also important in our thinking. And I can send you the link to that.
I would love that.
Yeah. And then, you know, one of the things that I did was I just talked to a lot of people. I talked to you in part of the process. A long time ago, exactly, in the early days. I talked to leaders from Oxfam and from Save the Children and from, you know, many different organizations just to learn and hear from them what their experience was and then try to make sense of it for IPASS. So, you know, we spent a lot of time just kind of thinking and learning from the outside, and then asking our staff as well. So,
yeah, like you said,
I don't know. I think this process has exceeded anything that I could have imagined.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, it's like it's that truism about teamwork, right? Yes, you could do it alone, and you could probably do it faster, but if you want to like do it better and in a more lasting way, you work in a team. And so this, you know, it's been so clear to me that, you know, my own ideas about this were so much more limited than the ideas that the people around me had and brought to bear.
Yeah, so that's the diversity of perspectives, et cetera, and the richness that came from that. All right. Well, I know we need to bring it to a close. So where should people go? This was terribly interesting. Where should people go to learn more about you, about IPASS, and about the change process?
So I think the best place is really our website, www.ipas.org. There you can find information about our strategy and our mission, but then also on the leadership page, you'll find information on our, you know, organizational leadership, and at the very bottom, a series of writings that of articles that I've written on this topic. I think that would probably be the best place.
The best place. Okay, then thanks also for pointing me to that those series of articles, because then I better benefit from that as well. Thank you, Anu, for the very rich learning that you have shared today, for your insights, and thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast interesting and stimulating, as I hope you did, please be sure to check out some other podcast episodes that we have on topics such as localization, shifting power, and networked structures in nonprofits. For instance, there's the episode 59 on network structures as they were articulated by Oxfam International in the interview with Doris Basler, for instance. There are several other episodes, 22, 39, 53, and 59. For instance, they're all largely on this topic of change leadership and change management in service of these bigger goals. You can find this and more on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org. That is with the number 5, as well as on my YouTube channel. And I hope you will subscribe to my email. Then you will always be the first to be in the know when we have dynamite episodes dropping like this one. And in the meantime, till we talk again, See you next time on NGO Soul and Strategy.
Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, 5oaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@5oaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.